KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
President Trump has announced business deals worth hundreds of billions of dollars with Saudi Arabia today.
The president also says the U.S. will end sanctions on Syria.
We'll have the latest details on this Tuesday, May 13th, on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Dallas Mavericks ended up with the top pick in the next NBA draft.
That is the craziest set of circumstances. I cannot believe it went out like that. 1.8% chance it changes the landscape of their situation.
Also, the resentencing hearing for Lyle and Eric Menendez begins today.
And we have a winner for the NPR Music Tiny Desk Contest.
Ruby Ibarra, who sings and raps in several languages from the Philippines.
I've always wanted to show people just the different vast languages that exist out there that very much deserve to be in music as well.
Those stories and more after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump is in Saudi Arabia, the first leg of his three-nation visit to the Middle East this week. Along with the deal-making and a lavish welcome, Trump also called on Iran to take a new and better path as he continues to push for a nuclear deal with Tehran.
They cannot have a nuclear weapon. This is an offer that will not last forever. The time is right now for them to choose. Right now, we don't have a lot of time to wait.
Trump announced, meanwhile, he'll ease sanctions against Syria and said he'll meet Wednesday in Saudi Arabia with new Syrian President Ahmed al-Shara. Trump said he hopes the new Syrian government, which ousted longtime leader Bashar al-Assad, succeeds. Lyle and Eric Menendez are moving a step closer to freedom after 35 years in prison for murdering their parents. A Los Angeles Superior Court judge has ruled the brothers' sentences of life in prison without parole are being reduced to 50 years to life. That makes them eligible for parole under California's youthful offender law because they committed the murders before they were 26. They'll remain jailed while a parole board reviews the new sentences. Menendez brothers were found guilty of murdering their parents, Kitty and Jose Menendez, in 1989 and were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Brothers claimed they'd been sexually abused by their father and feared for their lives. The Food and Drug Administration is seeking to remove fluoride tablets for kids from the market. Their prescription fluoride supplements taken by children prevent tooth decay in some circumstances. More from NPR's Ping Wong.
Under Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Food and Drug Administration is starting the process of taking prescription-only fluoride supplements off the market. Dr. Paul Casamassimo with the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry says these are recommended for kids who don't get fluoridated water to prevent cavities.
This removes the choice. It really removes one of the tools that we as clinicians can use to stem tooth decay.
The announcement claims ingested fluoride can change the microbiome in concerning ways, even as it links to scientific papers that suggest low doses of fluoride may positively affect the microbiome. It contradicts recommendations from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and professional medical groups. Ping Huang, NPR News.
Chipmaker NVIDIA says it will partner with a Saudi sovereign wealth fund owned by the AI startup Humane as part of a plan to ship 18,000 chips to the Middle Eastern nation to help power a new data center project there. The partnership was revealed today as part of a White House trip to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. Saudi Arabia has been working to develop its artificial intelligence capacity and strengthen its cloud computing capabilities. Stocks closed mixed on Wall Street today amid new signs of inflation easing in April. The Dow was down 269 points. The Nasdaq rose 301 points. This is NPR. United Health Group says its CEO Andrew Witty is stepping down for what the company is calling personal reasons. Witty took over last year after the murder of former CEO Brian Thompson. The company also announced today it's suspending its full-year forecast due to higher-than-expected medical costs. United Health announced today that effective immediately, Stephen Hemsley will return as CEO of the company. Hemsley served as CEO from 2006 to 2017. Last month, the company announced quarterly earnings that came in below expectations. Its stock plunged 17% today. The 78th Cannes Film Festival kicked off today in the south of France. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports actor Robert De Niro, a top honorary award, and festival goers will have to abide by a new dress code.
To thunderous applause, actor Leonardo DiCaprio presented his hero, Robert De Niro, with a prestigious Palme d'Or. The two-time Academy Award winner was honored for his iconic roles in such films as The Godfather Part II, Taxi Driver, and Raging Bull.
Merci infiniment to the Festival de Cannes for creating a community, a home, if you will, for those of us who love the art of telling stories on screen.
During his acceptance speech, De Niro slammed President Trump, who he called an enemy of the arts. This year's festival goers faced an updated dress code, no nudity on the red carpet and other events, and no voluminous outfits, such as gowns with large trains that hinder traffic and complicate seating. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices moved higher today. Oil up nearly 3% to $63.67 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump landed in Saudi Arabia early this morning. It is the first big trip of his second term, and it was also the first place he traveled to back in 2017. He says the Middle East has been transformed since then by a new generation of leaders focused on business and technology.
This great transformation has not come from Western interventionists or flying people in beautiful planes giving you lectures on how to live and how to govern your own affairs, no.
And there is a new leader from the region that Trump plans to meet tomorrow for the first time, the new president of Syria. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez joins us now from Riyadh at the end of a very, very long day. Hi, Franco.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so the White House says Trump will meet tomorrow with the Syrian president, Ahmed al-Sharaa. Can you just tell us what you think is the significance of this meeting we're expecting?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's likely going to be a very short meeting, just a few hellos. But this really is a big shift in U.S. foreign policy. Now, Trump sees this as a chance for stability in Syria after decades of civil war.
I will be ordering the cessation of sanctions against Syria in order to give them a chance at greatness.
The U.S. has had sanctions in place since 1979, and the new president, until this year, led a group that had links to al-Qaeda. Trump has said he decided to lift the sanctions after speaking with the Saudi crown prince and the president of Turkey, and it really was a significant moment of diplomacy in a trip that is expected to be defined by business deals.
Right. Okay, business deals. But can we talk about the bigger picture here? Like, what is Trump, in your mind, looking to get out of this trip?
Well, a lot of it is about getting, you know, demonstrating stronger ties between the two countries. I mean, they really rolled out the red carpet for Trump, or in this case, in Saudi's case, a lavender carpet.
Oh.
You know, Trump was escorted to the Saudi airport by a group of F-15 fighter jets, and the whole day was incredibly lavish with two Arabian horse welcomes, there were camels and multiple receptions. We just got back from a big state dinner where there were traditional drummers. And just to go back a moment, there was a lot of pomp and circumstance during Trump's first visit here in 2017. But former President Joe Biden had a real difficult relationship with the crown prince. You know, he didn't even want to shake his hand on camera. He gave him a fist bump. And this was because of the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi,
right,
and also the U.S. intelligence assessment that the crown prince had approved the operation. But that was then, and now Trump called Saudi crown prince Mohammed bin Salman an incredible man and praised him extensively throughout the day. And you heard that clip at the top that Trump said he's not here to lecture. He wants to make business deals.
Yeah, let's go back to those business deals. What kind of deals did Trump actually make?
Well, I can tell you there was a long list of CEOs here today with Trump, from NVIDIA, OpenAI, Elon Musk, of course, financial firms and defense contractors. The White House says there were about $142 billion in arms deals with more than a dozen U.S. firms and $80 billion in technology investments. And we're really going to expecting to see more of that during other stops on the trip to Qatar and UAE.
Well, given the various conflicts in the region at the moment, I mean, real quick, Franco, what did Trump have to say about those conflicts?
Well, when it came to the war in Gaza, he really didn't say much. He did say that it was his dream for Saudi Arabia to normalize relations with Israel by joining the Abraham Accords. But that's something that the Crown Prince has said it won't be possible until the war ends.
That is NPR's Franco Ordonez in Riyadh. Thank you so much, Franco.
Thank you also.
The Trump administration wants to eliminate or weaken 47 Department of Energy regulations, including some efficiency standards for appliances. One problem, though, efficiency advocates say that would be illegal, as NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
President Trump has long complained about energy-efficient appliances and water-saving faucets.
You wash your hands, and in my case, I like to take a nice shower to take care of my beautiful hair. I have to stand under the shower for 15 minutes till it gets wet. It comes out drip, drip, drip. It's ridiculous.
That was Trump last month signing an executive order to roll back Biden-era efficiency standards. Now the Department of Energy is announcing what it calls the largest deregulatory effort in history. Energy Secretary Chris Wright says the administration is slashing regulations that he claims restrict consumer choice because less efficient versions can no longer be sold. He plans to rescind conservation standards for kitchen appliances, washers and dryers, room air conditioners, and more. The department claims that will save Americans billions of dollars in coming years. But Andrew Dulaski with the Appliance Standards Awareness Project says that's wrong.
What the Trump administration is doing is they're only counting the cost and telling you to ignore the savings.
Dulaski says that more efficient products often are more expensive, but consumers end up saving a lot of money with lower utility bills. Dulaski also says the changes the Energy Department is proposing violate the law.
When Congress enacted this law way back in 1987 and President Reagan signed it, the law very specifically says that no new standard can be weaker than the one on the books today.
So if these changes the Energy Department is proposing are finalized, Dulaski predicts they likely will be challenged in court. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Folks, we have a winner. This year's NPR Music Tiny Desk Contest received nearly 7,500 entries from independent artists across the country. That's the most entries it has ever seen in its 11-year history. The artist who rose to the top is from California, the Bay Area specifically, and her name is Ruby Ibarra. I was born with two tongues, so I carry two guns. Sharper than a Bali song, blade in the sun. Stars in the sun, cause the moon phase one. Got a rhythm like a monsoon, bug you with the Ruby Ibarra joins us now. Congratulations.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me.
How are you feeling about all of this? I cannot imagine what it must be like for you.
I am elated. I've been left speechless ever since I found out the wonderful news. And I think I'm just very proud, not only of myself, but the band that I performed with. You know, this is a labor of love for all of us. And it really is a dream come true as independent artists.
I want to hear more about the winning song. It's called Bakunawa. What does that mean?
So the Bakunawa is actually a direct reference of a mythological creature based in Philippine mythology. It's about a dragon who swallows the moon. And I interpreted it as a metaphor for resistance and a battle cry against erasure. Because in the mythological story, this dragon swallows the moon and is then banished for swallowing the moon. And it's said that this dragon is the cause of natural phenomena such as earthquake, eclipses. And for me, I found something really powerful in that, especially since when I was writing this song, I was pregnant with my first child, with my daughter. And it felt like kind of a revolutionary statement of being resistant and fighting against being erased. And I think being a Filipina American artist as well, and knowing my history, the Philippine history, which, you know, is a lot of
colonial history and history that's been erased, to me, it really spoke loudly. And I wanted to kind of flip that story and use it as a sense of empowerment. Can I break this cycle? I was taught as truth. Rewrite my story.
I'm so curious about how motherhood and creating this beautiful song while pregnant impacted your creative process and the way you thought about making this song.
It was absolutely powerful for me. It was such a wonderful process to know that, you know, I was entering this new chapter of motherhood. And here I was surrounded by these amazing, strong women such as June Millington, Han Han, Wida, and our amazing all-female band. And I just felt like my daughter was already, you know, in the room with us and was part of this process. It's totally changed my perspective as a person, but it's also changed my perspective as a songwriter in knowing that the songs that I create from this moment on are definitely songs that I want to be able to share with my daughter and have themes and stories that I want to engage in dialogue with her someday.
Now, this is the first Tiny Desk Contest winning entry that is performed in three different languages. Tell us about that creative decision.
That decision to incorporate different languages was definitely intentional. It was very important to me that we had to showcase other Filipino languages in this song, including Tagalog and Bisaya is what's in the music and in the spoken word at the end. And for me, it was particularly important to showcase the Bisaya Filipino language as well, because the story of the Bakunawa is rooted from the Visayas, specifically from Cebu. And part of my family is also from the Visayas. So to me, it was just very meaningful to be able to include that and to also show people that, you know, across the world, oftentimes there's certain languages that are normalized or certain languages that become kind of the standard. Even in the Philippines alone, like Tagalog is typically the language that, you know, people hear in mainstream music and in film. And I've always wanted to challenge that narrative and to show people just, you know, the different vast languages that exist out there that very much deserve to be in music as well.
That was Ruby Ibarra, the winner of the 2025 Tiny Desk Contest. You can see the video for her winning song on the NPR Music website now and catch her on tour later this summer. Ruby, thank you so much and excited to see you.
Thank you so much.
Support for NPR and the Tiny Desk Contest comes from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from Lagunitas Brewing Company, since 1993, committed to challenging the status quo and brewing innovative beer, featuring a range of craft brews and non-alcoholic options. Learn more at Lagunitas.com. History rooted in my people's death. This breath been enveloped, consumed, swallowed whole. On nights where one moon seems fleeting so, even seven moons don't illuminate like my soul. My rage, spoon feeder, moon eater, truth keeper.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. And from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. A 1 in 55 chance. Those were about the odds that the Dallas Mavericks had in last night's NBA draft lottery to win the top overall pick.
Bro.
Brad said bro more than I've ever heard him say it tonight.
That is the craziest set of circumstances. I cannot believe it went out like that.
Well, Dallas did win the pick, leaving a whole lot of people, like ESPN's Brian Windhorst, absolutely shocked. The Mavericks are now set up real nice for the summer's draft, but some fans are wondering, was it good luck or was it something else altogether? NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan is here to tell us all about it. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
All right, Becky. I mean, there are a whole lot of NBA fans out there online. They're crying rigged over the past 24 hours. So please help us understand, why did the Mavs winning the top pick prompt that response?
Well, I think you alluded to it with the odds. You know, the way the NBA draft lottery works is that every team who didn't make the playoffs has a shot at winning the top overall pick, but your chances go down the better a team you are. So, like, the worst teams have the biggest chance, and the team that barely missed the playoffs, they have the smallest odds. Well, that was the Mavs, they only had a 1.8 chance, as you heard, of winning that top pick, and yet their number came up. How lucky for them.
How lucky indeed. Then there's the context, too, that we just have to get into here, and that is the Luka trade.
Exactly. Yeah. So sort of big picture, before the season started, it would have been a surprise that the Mavs were even in contention for the lottery because they were one of the best teams in the league last year. They went to the NBA Finals, and that was thanks, of course, to the play of their superstar, Luka Doncic. This past February, the Mavs stunned the sports world by trading Luka, who was only 25 at the time, to the Los Angeles Lakers. In return, they got Anthony Davis, who is also a great player, but he's older. He has a lengthy injury history. And so this trade was widely viewed as a gigantic mistake for Dallas. Fans were calling for their GM to be fired, yet here the Mavs are now, just a few months later, sitting pretty with the top overall pick in their hands because of this lottery. It's expected that they'll take the Duke freshman phenom Cooper Flagg, who is regarded as basically one of the best draft prospects of the past decade or so. So just an incredible stroke of luck for the Mavs, who seemed to have fumbled away their generational player.
I mean, look, Becky, I have to ask you this question, and perhaps it's unanswerable, but is the NBA rigged?
I mean, I think no, right? I think people like to think so, right? Because there is like a little bit of a history now of these sort of like narratively pitch perfect draft lottery picks. So just like for one example, you had the Chicago Bulls getting the draw in 2008 with a 1.7% chance when this hometown player, Derrick Rose, was up for grabs. I mean, there's like a few other examples like that. But the lottery is conducted with representatives for all those teams and members of the media present. There's also somebody from an independent accounting firm, Ernst & Young, there to oversee the whole thing. So I don't think it's rigged. But I think basketball as a sport is a little prone to these accusations because there is a history of some scandals involving individual refs or individual players betting on games they were involved in. But I think big picture, like a lot of things in our society these days, the sports fan sort of social media world has become a hotbed of conspiratorial thinking. A boom in sports gambling has not helped. Not limited to the NBA, of course, it's across all sports.
You know, I love a good conspiracy. Meanwhile, Becky, we cannot forget the NBA playoffs are going on too.
True. Yeah. So that's an important counterpoint to the rigged narrative, I must say, Juana, because we've got small market teams thriving here. And that's the opposite of what you'd imagine if you believed the conspiracy minded folks. You've got the Pacers looking great. You have the Timberwolves looking great. Both of those teams are up 3-1 in their respective series. Neither of them have ever won a title. And the Thunder, Oklahoma City Thunder, looking great too. So that kind of parity is great for the league, great for fans, and nothing to be conspiratorial about.
Lots to be excited about, though. That is NPR's Becky Sullivan. Thank you.
You're so welcome.
In In Los Angeles today, Superior Court Judge Michael Jessick has ruled Eric and Lyle Menendez's sentences of life in prison without parole are being reduced to 50 years to life. This makes them eligible for parole after 35 years in prison for murdering their parents. The Menendez brothers were found guilty in 1996 and were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. They maintained that they had been sexually abused by their father and that they feared for their lives. Steve Futterman has been in the courtroom in Van Nuys and joins us from there. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Elsa.
So what exactly did the judge say in his ruling?
Well, it was a remarkable day inside the courtroom. The judge heard testimony from several relatives of Eric and Lyle Menendez. They said the brothers were no threat to commit another violent crime. Now, that was the key threshold in allowing Judge Michael Jessick to resentence them. He later heard very emotional pleas, I would say almost confessions, from the brothers. They spoke by a video link from the prison where they are being held. At the end of the day, the judge said he is resentencing them, as you said, to 50 years to life. Their original sentence was life in prison without the possibility of parole. A very key part of this resentencing is that they are now eligible for parole. They could go before a parole board as early as next month. If the board recommends their release, though, they could still be vetoed by California Governor Gavin Newsom.
Okay, so still some moving pieces to this. What were the arguments you heard in court today about this resentencing?
Well, the attorney for the brothers, Mark Garagos, argued that they have served 35 years. He said if any case calls for a reduction, it's Eric and Lyle Menendez. Now, among the relatives testifying today was Anna Maria Baralt. She said, and this is a quote, there is zero chance they would ever commit another crime. And she spoke with reporters outside the courthouse.
I know Lyle and Eric. I know them personally. I know their growth. I've seen their journeys. And they are absolutely well suited for this process for resentencing. And I have no doubt that if we stay fair throughout this proceedings, that we will see them out.
Now, the district attorney, Nathan Hochman, this morning before even court began, again said what he's been saying before, now is not the time.
Our position is not no, or it's not never, it's not yet. And the reason we said that is that the Menendez brothers have failed to come clean with the full extent of their criminal conduct, their cover-up, their lies, and their deceit over the past 30 years.
And this is pretty much the argument the judge heard inside the courtroom, but he went ahead and resentenced the brothers.
And Steve, can you tell us more about what the brothers said on video from prison today?
Well, as I said, it was quite moving. Each spoke for around 10 minutes from the prison near San Diego. Both were wearing blue prison garb. Lyle went first. He said there was no justification for what was done. Everything he did, he said, was his choice. There were some tears at times, it seemed, as well. He also addressed briefly the issue of sexual abuse. He said he didn't think anyone would ever believe their claims. Eric Menendez said his parents should be alive, and he described in graphic detail firing the weapon.
And what reaction have you been hearing so far to this resentencing?
Well, outside the courtroom after the ruling, there was quite a bit of elation from the supporters of the brothers. Mark Garrico said he believes they will be released perhaps as early as this year. The Menendez relatives on both sides of the family who had been urging the court to resentence them, they were also elated. Now, some of them were hoping the judge today might actually reduce the crime to manslaughter and release them immediately, but realistically, they felt the best chance was to get the sentence reduced to 50 years to life, and that's exactly what happened today here in a very dramatic day in Los Angeles, Elsa.
That is Steve Futterman reporting in Van Nuys, California. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you, Elsa.
This is NPR News.
Since taking over the Department of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has fired thousands of workers and canceled billions in grants. Now Congress is getting a say in those changes.
There has always been bipartisan support for HHS programs. That's how they survived.
That story tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, a new book by Ocean Vuong.
It centers on a friendship between a young college dropout and an older woman with dementia.
The immense loneliness of the very young and the very old was actually a binding, beautiful moment for us.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. As President Trump continues his Middle East trip this week, he appears ready to accept a free plane offer from the Qatari government to replace Air Force One. Trump defended his plan, calling it, quote, a very nice gesture. But Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says it raises questions about corruption and national security. Schumer says he wants answers from Attorney General Pam Bondi.
How is this gift not naked corruption? The Attorney General must testify before both the House and Senate to explain why gifting Donald Trump a private jet does not violate the Emoluments Clause, which requires congressional approval, or any ethics law.
In a social media post, Trump said the Boeing 747 is being given to the U.S. Department of Defense and not to him. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries calls it a flying palace and says it's an unconstitutional gift if it's not approved by both houses of Congress. Vaccine experts are questioning a big new project launched by the administration to create what's known as a universal flu vaccine. NPR's Rob Stein has more in this report.
The Department of Health and Human Services will spend $500 million to try to create a flu vaccine that doesn't have to be updated every year. That's long been an elusive goal for vaccine researchers. But many vaccine scientists are puzzled by the new project, known as Generation Gold Standard. That's because the project is using an old technology that involves injecting people with whole viruses that have been inactivated to make them harmless but still capable of stimulating an immune response. Vaccine experts say newer technologies are more promising and produce fewer side effects. Rob Stein, NPR News.
On Wall Street, stocks finished higher. This is NPR. A Georgia college student living in the country illegally remains in the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Police say they made a mistake when they arrested her last week. Lily Oppenheimer reports.
Dalton police say they got the wrong car, and community members are flooding the department's social media pages with accusations of racial profiling. Police say the charges against 19-year-old Jimena Arias Cristobal are being dropped. Her attorney says she could be deported. A GoFundMe post set up to pay her legal fees and bond says she was brought to the U.S. with her family at 4 years old. When asked about accountability, Dalton police say there's an internal review process in place. Arias Cristobal's attorney says a bond hearing is set for next week. The family says her father, Jose Arias Tovar, is also being held at the same ICE facility. He was arrested during a separate traffic stop. For NPR News, I'm Lily Oppenheimer in Atlanta.
Consumers got a little break at the gas pump and grocery store last month as inflation cooled down just a little bit. The latest numbers from the Labor Department show consumer prices were up 2.3%, the smallest increase in more than 4 years. Economists warn, however, inflation could rise in the coming months as a result of President Trump's tariffs. Much will depend on what's finally implemented when the administration negotiates trade deals with countries, including China. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station.
And from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Today, the novelist and poet Ocean Vuong sits among an elite sliver of celebrated U.S. writers. His debut novel, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, won a bunch of awards in 2019. He got a MacArthur Fellowship, known as a genius grant. He's on faculty at NYU. All of that is very different from the environment where he grew up, raised by working-class Vietnamese immigrants in Hartford, Connecticut, a place a lot like the post-industrial town of East Gladness, where his latest novel is set. Here's how Ocean Vuong describes it early in his new book, The Emperor of Gladness.
It's a town where high school kids, having nowhere to go on Friday nights, park their stepfather's trucks in the unlit edges of the Walmart parking lot, drinking Smirnoff out of Poland Spring bottles and blasting Weezer and Lil Wayne until they look down one night to find a baby in their arms and realize they're 30-something and the Walmart hasn't changed except for its logo, brighter now, lending a bluish glow to their time-gaunt faces.
The novel centers on an unlikely friendship between a 19-year-old college dropout named Hai and an 82-year-old with dementia named Grazina. Ocean Vuong told me the two have something important in common.
Well, I think in many ways we throw around the phrase quintessential America, and we can say it's the white picket fence, it's the American dream. But what I actually thought looking at these two people was that they both come from war. Grazina flees Stalin in World War II. Hai and his family fled the war in Vietnam. And there's nothing more quintessentially American than to have two strangers who survived two wars 30 years apart meet and actually share this sort of shared bond of survival. And to me, I want to reframe America as not just this place of opportunity, but a place where things can be salvaged through debris. Both Hai and Grazina are debris ejected from two horrifying geopolitical ruptures, but they are not trash. They are not garbage. They are debris that has picked themselves up and created a new life.
The last page of this book says, in memory of Grazina J. Vercellis, 1925 to 2014, and reading that suddenly threw the rest of the novel into a different kind of context for me. I was dying to know, who is she? Who is this other Grazina?
She was an incredible woman who I managed to live with as I was going through college. I dropped out of Pace University and I lost my housing. And when I signed up to study at Brooklyn College, I got in, but I didn't have housing. Eventually, a friend of mine basically said, my grandmother is living alone, and if you go and live with her and just take care of her, you have a room. And I didn't know what I was getting into. I was, 19. I thought taking care of just meant being there. But boy, right away I learned words like dementia, words like Aricept,
That's a word I don't know.
Yeah, it's a medication for dementia. And I realized in this country, both the young and the very old have been pushed on the margins. The young have been deemed inadequate. They don't have the means or the assets to contribute properly to American progress. And the old have been deemed defunct. They are outside of their working productive years. And the common ground between the 40, 50 years between us was that we were both completely isolated, and the immense loneliness of the very young and the very old was actually a binding, beautiful moment for us. And I would sit there watching The Price is Right with her as if I was sitting with my grandmother. And it really changed what I thought human interactions and human potential could be, because it really wasn't about our racial differences or our cultural ones. It was about necessity. I found out that living with her, I was more useful to her than I was ever to myself. Hmm. And it changed how I considered my role as an artist, wow, as a person, and it was really important.
Do you want to take a moment?
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. Take your time. Do you want a drink of water?
Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay, sure. Yeah. The first time these two characters meet, Hai tells Grazina, "My dream was to write a novel that held everything I loved, including unlovable things." Mm. Is that also your dream? Is that what this novel is?
Yes, absolutely. Growing up in Hartford, my family and I came from Vietnam. We didn't have a lot of English, and we were living in one-bedroom apartment on government assistance, sponsored by the Salvation Army, bless their hearts. And we were invited into the Baptist church, and that's where I first encountered the myth of Noah's Ark. Hmm. And I thought it was real as a 7-8-year-old. I said, my goodness, what a life to build something and put everything into it that would survive an apocalypse. What would I put? And to me, it's the beautiful things and the ugly things that will then teach us how to be and how to learn from each other.
In this book, there are so many moments where ugly things are happening and they are described in a beautiful way, whether it is a pig slaughterhouse or a character who's in recovery relapses, and you write, "He was warm as a blood cell being swept through the vein of a fallen angel, finally good." Is there a kind of, I don't know, power or even radicalism in bringing beauty to ugliness, to the unlovable things, to scenes even of horror?
I think so. And in this sense, I have to credit the women who raised me. I was raised by my grandmother and my mother and my aunts, all of whom were illiterate, but they were not without the capacity for wonder. And I think when you have so little to give your children, as they did as refugees, they gave me the capacity to understand wonder. There is an epistemology to understanding and learning how to be befuddled and at awe of the world at once. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that became really technique and craft. The challenge is, can you look at the world long enough to worship the potential of it? And I think language is really interesting, because how you describe something reveals who you are. Description is DNA. And so the more we describe the world, the more we actually share our values, our perspectives. And I think there is a kind of Buddhist ethos to what I believe in my description, is that nothing is irredeemable. Even the ugly, the worst of us have potential to be salvaged. And to me, the sentence perhaps is the most capacious medium for that effort.
That's Ocean Vuong. His new novel is The Emperor of Gladness. Tomorrow, what he learned from working in fast food and how that shaped his characters.
This is NPR News. Perimenopause is a hot topic among Gen Xers and millennials, and these generations are ready to shake off the stigma associated with this stage of life. But perimenopause has a long list of symptoms. It can be hard to know when you're actually in it. NPR's Katia Riddle reports on that question. Is it perimenopause, or is it something else?
It's often clear enough when someone is in menopause, they stop having a period. But perimenopause, the years leading up to it, when hormones start to fluctuate, can be a lot more sneaky. Perimenopause can be a few years or closer to 10. It can show up in the early 40s or the late 40s. It can have a few symptoms. It can have a lot of symptoms. One thing perimenopausal women interviewed for this story said consistently, you just don't feel like yourself, like Rachel Belinsky.
For example, my dogs started to get on my nerves so badly, which they're like my whole world. So I knew something was very off.
At the time she started perimenopause, she was 51. She was having hot flashes. Emotional changes and mood swings can be part of the equation for many women. Belinsky felt rage, irritability, and depression.
So that's where it's complicated, because I've always been on the depressive side.
Midlife can already be an emotionally difficult time with caretaking responsibilities, family relationships, and just aging. Monica Christmas is the Associate Medical Director of the Menopause Society. She says one important step in grappling with this chapter of life, accepting the uncertainty of it all.
The menopause transition, otherwise called perimenopause, is the most tumultuous time frame for many people.
Often, says Christmas, it's not that women aren't making estrogen during perimenopause, it's that they're making it inconsistently. That can make people feel inconsistent.
It's a pretty vulnerable time frame in a woman's life.
Not only is it hard for women to figure out if they're in perimenopause, it can be hard for doctors to diagnose it. Some experts recommend testing for other conditions as a first clinical step. Nanette Santoro is a gynecologist in Colorado who treats menopause.
The 40s are a time in life when a lot of different autoimmune diseases can begin to show up.
Santoro says many conditions can have similar symptoms to perimenopause, and some are easier to diagnose.
Quite often I will do a miniature workup for making sure there's no signs of early diabetes, which happens in this age group. There's no signs of thyroid problems, which is fairly common in women, and that deserves to be checked every now and then.
Using a process of elimination to identify perimenopause, she says, is often more reliable than checking hormone levels.
If it's not well timed to the menstrual cycle, you may get misleading tests, and even then you still may get misleading tests because they vary from month to month.
Hormone therapy is one treatment that does help people. Both of these experts cautioned that despite what some influencers would suggest, hormone therapy is not a necessity for everyone. It carries some risks and side effects. The research on it is still evolving. Santoro says women also undergo metabolic changes at this age and lose muscle mass. The basics, healthy eating, sleeping enough, weight-bearing exercise, is more important than ever and may have more impact than medication.
So pretty much what your mother told you, yeah, and just do more of it.
One thing both doctors and patients agree on, women need to advocate for themselves and not accept suffering. That may mean seeing a specialist or seeking out a different provider. After a long odyssey of different treatments, Rachel Belinsky has just started hormone therapy. She's hoping it will get her back to the things she used to enjoy.
I just want to care about my dogs and the people around me. I want to have a little bit of that part of me come back to life.
A life that will look different in the second half, she says, but can still be great. Katie Arell, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. An emergency ruling from the Supreme Court last week allowed the Trump administration to continue enacting its ban on transgender military service members. While the legal challenge to this policy plays out in a federal appeals court, the U.S. military is offering voluntary separation to trans troops, and it will start involuntary separation after that. Over the years, we have spoken with Colonel Bree Fram of the U.S. Space Force. She is one of the highest-ranking transgender service members in the armed forces, and she joins us now. It's good to speak with you again, Colonel Fram.
Always good to talk with you, Elsa. I just wish we had better things to talk about.
I know. Okay, well, I just want to make clear, you are still active duty as of now, correct?
That's true, and I'm speaking with you today in my personal capacity, though, and my views are not necessarily reflective of the Department of Defense.
Understood. Okay, so you have had about a week, Colonel Fram, to process the Supreme Court ruling. What has been going through your mind?
Well, I was devastated and heartbroken by the decision because it doesn't take into account the real harm that is occurring right now, not just to individual transgender service members, but also to this nation and to our national defense now and far into the future, because lives are being upended. And even if the court cases continue to play out, we are going to lose thousands of highly trained, highly capable, skilled individuals that are serving their nation and doing everything that is being asked of them right now here at home and deployed all around the world.
What about you, Colonel Fram? The Trump administration has given active duty trans service members until early next month, right, to leave voluntarily. Have you reached a personal decision about what you will do? What can you tell us?
Oh, one thing I want to make clear is this is not a choice. No one is going to voluntarily choose to leave. We have been told that we are not wanted. And if this policy was not here, no one would be saying, I'm out. But right now, we're in the space where people have to make the best decision for them and for their families. And that includes me. How do I engage with this? Because I don't want to take the uniform off. When I was promoted to colonel several years ago, I felt like it was closer to the beginning than the end because there were so many amazing adventures ahead and quite an opportunity to train and develop the next generation. So I and thousands of others have to look at this and say, what works for me? Because if we don't take what is being offered in front of us right now, what are the additional adverse consequences that may come with the involuntary phase?
Right. So to repeat some of your words, like, how will you stay engaged if you do indeed have to take the uniform off?
Elsa, that's the million-dollar question. What I know is that I've got 22 plus years of service to this nation behind me. And if I have to take the uniform off, I don't expect that service to end. I swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution. And we do not swear oaths just to live up to them when it's easy. I absolutely expect later on to continue to live up to that oath and fight for what I believe is right in this nation and make that better tomorrow that we all believe in as Americans.
Well, while the Supreme Court ruling allows this ban on transgender troops to be enforced, legal challenges are proceeding in lower court. How hopeful are you that those courts, maybe even the Supreme Court eventually, will rule in favor of trans service members?
Well, I'm hopeful for several reasons. One, in the rulings we have already seen from the district courts that really pointed to our example of service as Exhibit A for why the government's arguments basically don't have a leg to stand on, and the experiences of not only the plaintiffs in the cases, but the thousands of service members that are meeting or exceeding standards.
Well, in the 30 seconds we have left, I just want to say, you know, the military's policy on trans service members has changed quite often, right? From President Obama to the first Trump term to Biden, now to the second Trump term. Does being in flux just feel kind of familiar to you, or does this moment feel somewhat different?
This has been an absolute roller coaster, and the emotional toll has been intense, but through it all, We have absolutely accomplished the mission, and that's what makes me so proud of transgender service members.
Colonel Briefran of the U.S. Space Force, thank you very much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Liam and Olivia are the two most popular names for newborns, according to new data from the Social Security Administration. But another name is rising in popularity, especially for girls in red states, Oakley, spelled in various ways. NPR's Netta Ulaby has more.
There are people who study names. Cleveland Evans is a professor and former president of the American Name Society. He clocked the Oakley trend a few years ago.
That one is one of those things that is coming out of Utah. Utah is sort of an early warning system for things that are going to become popular. This has to do with Latter-day Saint culture or Mormon culture. They are people who use unusual names.
This is true, says someone whose name is Dr. Oakes.
My name is Dallin D. Oakes. I'm an English linguistics professor at Brigham Young University.
Oakes has also written a scholarly article about names. He is not entirely sure why so many popular ones have emerged from his LDS culture, such as Jaden, Caden, Oakland, Oakley.
I could speculate we have more kids than some other states.
And possibly more online influencers. Oakes points out that Oak-based names are rising in popularity across the country, but when he looked at recent data from states ranked politically by the International Business Times,
every one of the top 10 red states had either an Oakland or an Oakley or both or something in the top 100 names of every one of the red states. On the other hand, and in comparison, they were only represented in two of the bluest states I sampled. Clearly, there's a pattern there.
So let's meet an Oak, a millennial Oak. Tyson Oak Carver was born in 1982.
I live in Canyon Lake, Texas. I am a realtor. I also build motorcycles and play music. Our band is called Texas Renegade.
Carver's parents liked nature-based names. He has a theory about why oak-based ones might be popular in his red state.
You know, I'm staring at a huge live oak tree out my window right now. We've got them all over the place. So that is something that people see around here, is these large oak trees.
They are established. Their roots run deep. When Oakley Grant was growing up in Kansas in the 1990s, her main association with her name were the sunglasses brand and gunslinger Annie Oakley. But she says she was named after her grandfather and an uncle.
So we love to keep these names in the family.
Oakley Grant also loves that oak trees stand for sturdy, steadfast faith.
Oak can be used as a metaphor for God's people planted by him to display his glory. I like that. I like it a lot.
But when it came time to name her own child, Grant picked something a little more uncommon. Her daughter's name is Nova. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Had a big cigar in his mouth, so I knew he's from the South. Oh,